Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is November 2nd, 2023, and we're talking with Alan Gulledge, who is professor of molecular and systems biology at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. And Alan's work is on the cerebral cortex, the organization of the cerebral cortex, the cell types, their interaction, synaptic transmission between them, and modulation of synaptic transmission by neuromodulators, and physiology of the cerebral cortex, as he told me I should describe it. So, hi, Alan.
Hi, Charlie. It's great to be here.
Also with us today is David Jaffe. David is also a cortical physiologist and actually Alan's PhD advisor many years ago. Hi, David.
Hi, Charlie.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So, Alan, just to kind of get started, there's this sort of a weird and wonderful effect of acetylcholine in the cortex that's been known about since the 1970s, or it's been partly known about in some ways since the 1970s. And it's always been a little bit of a mystery because acetylcholine isn't a standard transmitter in the usual sense. It was first described as having just slow modulatory effects and not really having any direct effect on spiking at all. Gradually, it started to have more direct effects on spiking as people look closer and closer. And there are other molecules like that. Serotonin is another one like that, too. And those modulators, which once we accept, wrapped our mind around the idea that they don't cause spikes, they only alter the spikes caused by others, that then we start to discover that they can actually cause spikes. Serotonin has receptors that are fast neurotransmission, for fast neurotransmission, and acetylcholine also. So can you fill us in about neuromodulators in the cortex and their job and what we know about them now?
So I think in terms of cortical physiology, we normally think of neurons talking to each other through these amino acid transmitters. So glutamate is an amino acid that's an excitatory transmitter, and GABA is an inhibitory transmitter. And those are the two most commonly thought about transmitters in the cortex and in many other parts of the brain. And they work in large part by activating ion channels on target neurons. So they're very rapid. The ion channel opens very quickly, and you have synaptic currents that can change the behavior of neurons on a very rapid time scale. Many other neurotransmitters like acetylcholine, like serotonin, can act at a variety of receptor subtypes. So in fact, for both of those, there are some ligand-gated ion channels that respond to acetylcholine or serotonin. But there's also a lot of G protein coupled receptors. So these aren't ion channels themselves, but they couple to some biochemical signaling cascades within neurons that can then change how those neurons compute these faster inputs from glutamate and GABA.
So why, dumb question maybe, but why have both of those kinds of things? What does the cortex get for having acetylcholine, for example?
Right, or any other neuromodulator, and there's many dozens of them, lots of peptides and other things. That's a great question, right? I'd love to know why, but I think the overall sense in neuroscience is that these neuromodulators, which they're often called, change the way that neurons respond to patterns of these more traditional fast synaptic inputs. And so you might be able to have a neuron that has a variety of output in terms of their action potential genesis, even if they're receiving an identical pattern of synaptic input, depending on which of these other neuromodulators are in the environment at the time.
So these set up some kind of state for the circuit and alter the circuit's function in some way?
Is it
qualitative or is it just a quantitative shift?
Well, they are states, right? So we define certain brain states, like, you know, during wakefulness with the desynchronized state. If you do a EEG and you see a desynchronized state, we think of that as a conscious state. And that state is associated with acetylcholine release, for instance. Interestingly, of all the neuromodulators, the one that's released during sleep, during specifically rapid eye movement periods of sleep, where we have conscious experience of dreaming, is acetylcholine. And again, we have a desynchronized state during what otherwise is considered sleep, which is normally not desynchronized. In the slow wave sleep, you have a very different EEG pattern. So brain state is exactly probably the correct way to think about it, is it's changing the state of the network, in this case, a cortical network, to respond differently to whatever pattern of input it's getting at the time.
So desynchronized means that the cortex isn't just listening to its own interaction, but it's listening to inputs from outside the cortex. Is that what we really mean?
Well, I think that its cortex is always listening to input from outside the cortex, right? The thalamus especially is a main driver of cortical activity. I think that it may change the way that the cortex responds to afferent input. There's some thought that thalamic afferents are maybe preferred during acetylcholine states in cortex. Acetylcholine, in addition to affecting how neurons behave, it can also affect how neurotransmitter is released. So, for instance, glutamatergic and GABAergic terminals, these fast classic connections between cortical neurons, presynaptic receptors for, say, acetylcholine and other neuromodulators can change the way those terminals release transmitter. And that will change, you know, the entire structure of information flow. And some terminals, like cortical terminals, we find are sensitive to acetylcholine in that it reduces the glutamate release or the likelihood of glutamate release from a terminal. And there are other terminals that seem like they are not suppressed by acetylcholine. So the assumption would be that when there's acetylcholine around, maybe the balance of weights between different types of excitatory input to cortex is going to change, and in this case, maybe in favor of thalamocortical afferents.
So that kind of fits my really primitive idea about what desynchronized activity in the cortex means, which is the cortical signals are not dominating, and signals of non-cortical origin that represent the world are enhanced a little bit. And so if cortical synapses get knocked down a little bit, they tend to synchronize the cortex. Is that, I mean, you seem to reluctant to go for that.
I guess, I mean, reluctant in part because I don't think of it as sensing the world necessarily, right? So during REM sleep, you have a lot of acetylcholine, you have a lot of thalamic cortical activity, but you're not really sensing the world potentially, right? What's interesting to me about those states is they're kind of internally generated conscious experiences, and I'm by no means a sleep expert, but I do find it fascinating that the cortex is in a, you know, they call it paradoxical sleep because it looks like the cortex is in an awake state from a electrical point of view, this desynchronized state, and yet clearly someone is not conscious as we, you know, awake.
Are those, I mean, this is going far afield from a ordinary cortical physiology, but you triggered it for me. I can't help asking it. So if a dream is kind of like a fake reality as far as the cortex is concerned and looks very similar in the cortex to reality, then where does the signal for the dream come from? Is the cortex dreaming that up, and then we'd normally think of the cortex as an analyzer of signals from elsewhere. But where's the dream being made?
Right, so that's a great question. So it's internally generated. I think most people would think that dreams are internally generated. And could that happen in a cortex by itself? I think a problem is that nothing exists in isolation. Kind of a traditional view is that you have this hierarchy of cortical areas, right? And that you have these higher cortical areas, these associational areas, which are going to give a top-down point of view to these lower order areas, right? And from that perspective, you might think that higher order cortex is generating these conscious experiences. But of course, they're hooked up to striatum and thalamus with lots of recurrent loops. And in fact, there's, I think in this month or last month's Nature Neuroscience, there's a paper called the Shallow Brain Hypothesis, which is doesn't discount that there's kind of a hierarchy in cortical areas, but presents it as maybe functionally that's not as important as these recurrent loops through cortex to subcortical structures. And so in that, from that view, where are dreams made? Maybe everywhere all at once. I don't know.
So that sort of raises the issue of where the modulators come from, because one of the things about modulators in the cortex is most of them are not released by cortical neurons. They come from somewhere else. Yeah. Serotonin and acetylcholine are great examples of that. So if the purpose of the modulator is sort of to shift gears in the brain and shift it from one kind of processing to another, then that decision is being made through those subcortical regions.
Right, which are generally hooked up to these loops somewhere, right? So acetylcholine, for instance, is thought to be involved by many in attention processes. And so that is a shift in state where you're going to focus attention on a particularly relevant aspect of your environment or goal that you might have. And you're right, they come from subcortical regions. I think that's maybe just a function of how the brain has evolved, right? As it's expanded, you have these regions where you have serotonergic neurons or cholinergic neurons, and they just feed this expanding forebrain that we have in mammals, for instance.
So, shifting gears came first before the gears that get just shifted.
Maybe so, right? Well, so, I kind of think of acetylcholine as, and again, this is just very speculative, but as a, I mentioned to you earlier that there are these phasic releases of acetylcholine that Martin Sartor described back in 2007. And the phasic release of acetylcholine coincides in time with animals orienting and starting initiating a behavior, a learned behavior, to get a reward. And I kind of think of acetylcholine as driving action outputs from setting the stage in the cortex to basically deliver some kind of action. And the fact that among cortical neurons, the most sensitive to acetylcholine, perhaps, are these neurons that project to motor systems in the brain stem, would fit with that. So, I think it is a lot about brain state and setting the stage so that these faster processes, these more traditional circuits, generate the correct output.
So most of your studies are on the output neurons of the cerebral cortex. So the cerebral cortex looks pretty shallow from the point of view of them. But there's a lot of other neurons in the cortex that feed into those. And there's some kind of final common pathway for most of the cortical output. Not all of it, because some of it goes from layer 6, I think. But a lot of it comes from layer 5.
Some of it comes from layer 2-3 too, right? So that's the rodent physiologist in me. But so we think of in frontal cortex as there being a layer 1, which is the, you know, this kind of dense matter of dendrites and axons, mostly devoid of cell bodies, but a place of a lot of synaptic connections. And then cells in layer 2-3, which is kind of a pyramidal cells and interneurons mixed, and in some parts of frontal cortex, the next layer would be layer 5. So there's not a defined layer 4 that you have in sensory cortex, but you have layer 5, which have projection neurons, and layer 6. And really all of those layers, except for layer 1, have cell bodies of neurons that project somewhere outside of the cortex to the striatum, the deeper ones to thalamus, to amygdala. So there's lots of targets, and they probably do differ from one brain area like frontal cortex to a different brain area in posterior cortex.
So we've learned to think of layer 5 pyramidal cells as being at least two different pathways, the one that projects just in the telencephalon, which people sometimes call IT, which isn't a terrible name, and the one that projects many other places, which is sometimes called PT, which actually is a terrible name because it's named after the pyramidal tract, which is fed by it, but not exclusively.
But not exclusive, yeah.
But anyway, these names, once they exist, there's no fighting them. And and those two pathways are really two different output channels for the cortex. But you're thinking that there could be many more.
There are many more. There for sure are many more. There are so many. I actually kind of wonder how many neurons don't project to striatum or to some other amygdala or some other non-cortical target. How many purely cortical neurons are there? I don't know. I think it might be a surprisingly small number.
Yeah, Alfonso Apicella in our department has shown that most of the GABAergic neurons project outside the cortex, which is a shocker for
It was a very surprising finding.
So when we think that, I think our traditional view of the cortex was a deep structure where the inputs started on one neuron and then shuffled to the next and to the next and to the next and finally made their way out through layer 5. But that's not necessarily so. We could have lots of different.
Well, and not just the traditional view of something coming into layer 4 and then being distributed to a more superficial layer, and then eventually, yes, getting to a layer 5 cell and generating output from that small, narrow section of cortex that may go to another area of cortex and start that process all over again, and then go to another higher order area of cortex. And one of the arguments this paper makes in Nature Neuroscience, and the first author's name I think is Suzuki, is that doesn't fit with how long it takes for us to process and solve problems with our brain, right? Our brain is faster than that. If you have so many synapses sequentially, serial synapses, things start to take a long time. But, you know, our brains are super fast, right? So last night was the final game of the World Series, right? And, you know, imagine a batter sitting there and watching, you know, a 90-mile-an-hour or faster ball and being able to make a decision and generate behavior. That's really rapid. That's faster than some of these more traditional thoughts would allow you to do.
Some things are slow. If I'm watching people play chess, it seems like they take forever to make up their minds.
That's true. But I think survival depends on rapid decision making and rapid action.
So the organization of the cortex that, you know, I was taught in school is basically wrong. It's what you just said. I was taught this hierarchical thing and also thought that each of those regions was a column, and there was a lot of processing inside the column, and then there were basically two exit points from the column. One went to cortical pathways, and one went out of the cortex. And that's become increasingly less convincing as we know more and more about the circuitry of the cortex. So what is our alternative model for the cortex? How should we think about it? Should we think of every spot in cortex as being a bunch of independent signal processing centers that just happen to live in the same place in cortex? Or is it, you know, is there still a column?
So that's a great question. I think there is still, I mean, there is microcircuitry that is kind of vertically oriented within these groupings of neurons that we traditionally call a column. There's been a lot of debate about what is a column, right?
Yeah.
Is barrel cortex, is that an example of a very large column? In visual cortex, you have very narrow, you know, as defined by orientation, selectivity, and things like that. But there is structure there. There is some local structure that is no doubt important, right? But I think the newer way to look at it that's, you know, I've been thinking about lately since reading this paper is that these exist in parallel with each other across huge expanse, maybe the entire expanse of cortex. And that parallel processing that's only two or three synapses in a loop between, you know, striatum or thalamus and back to cortex is a much faster and more efficient way maybe to solve problems, even if it seems less understandable than a kind of a hierarchical approach. But hopefully we do change our point of view on how these things work, because you know, we're almost always wrong on the first stab of things, and even the second and third, and things get refined, and things, our understanding changes, hopefully for the better.
So the way we've got the understanding that we have is by people doing the kind of work that you do. So you'll take a piece of cortex and record from two neurons at the same time, stimulate some input, see who's sharing input, who's connected to whom, what kind of synapses are there, and what do those synapses do? And that's an enormous effort. Luckily, there are a lot of people doing it, but the amount of that kind of stuff that was required for us to go from where we were, thinking about the cortex, to where we are now, was a lot. And I don't know, you want to estimate the total number of published papers that in that transition? It's thousands, I think. And I'm sort of trying to extrapolate into the future. So how much of the circuitry of the cortex do we think we have kind of mapped out at this point? And, you know, what proportion of the task is done? Are we going to have to do this for 100 years or 200 years?
Those are great questions. It's really hard to answer because the rate of new technology and is growing so fast. Like there's just so many new ways and better ways to ask these questions, right? And discover. I think on the first part is we probably know less than we think we do in terms of the types of neurons that are there and how they're connected to each other. It's actually, we know a lot less than we think we do. There's a lot left to understand. And your example of, you know, long-distance GABAergic projections, what are they playing, right? Those are, we're making these new discoveries all the time. But the advancement of tools like these genetic approaches and viral approaches to selectively kind of test and interrogate these structures, these cortical connections, not just in vitro, but in vivo in behaving animals is super powerful. And, you know, that has changed so much since I was in grad school here at UTSA. And I can't imagine it, you know, it's kind of an exponential thing. So in 10 years, it's going to be just literally unimaginably better in terms of scientific ability to ask these questions and test things. You know, I'm excited to find out what people discover. And then you have these large consortiums like the Allen Brain Institute and this European Human Brain Project that are, you know, doing tremendous work trying to understand exactly this question of how the neocortex works as a, you know, it's exciting. It's an exciting time to be alive, I guess.
That's for sure. Well, during the time I've been watching, which isn't all of that history, but it's some of it, the scope of the problem is the main thing that's exploded. So we thought there were so many interneurons, and now we think there's many times that number of interneurons, and each one of them is unique and has a unique place in the network and has a unique set of synaptic properties for its inputs and outputs. And are you worried about just that the new knowledge is causing the explosion of questions rather than the explosion of answers?
I think that's a great problem to have. I mean, of course you're going to have more new questions. That's the beauty of science, really. It's a question engine.
Yeah. I like questions too, but I'd like to see the end of, I'd like to know what the finish would look like. How would we know when we knew enough about, because as we study cortical organization, we learn cell types and synapse types, we're kind of building in our minds this circuitry that is the neural circuitry of the cortex. And that circuitry doesn't have, you know, any automatic behavior built into it or any automatic understanding of human thought or human emotion or anything. It is a machine of working components that we're putting together. And at some point, we hope that we'll turn that thing into an understanding of how the cortex creates a dream or creates a sense of reality or unreality. So I've heard this has been told to me many times that we know all the connections of this place or that place, but we still don't know what it does, right? The cerebellum was the first place that I ever heard anybody mm-hmm. say that. But now many things. People say, we know all this stuff about the cortex, but we still don't know what it does. So I'm just wondering, how do we answer those people? It seems to me obviously important to build this intellectual structure of the cortex to understand it as a machine so that we could sort of run maybe a real simulation, a computer simulation, or at least a mental imaging kind of simulation of what that circuit's doing. But then after we have that, how do we hook that up to everything else we know about, every question we'd like to answer about ourselves?
Those are big questions. One would like to think, I think, that if you did know enough about the machine, that it would become obvious how the machine generates what it generates. That may be hopeful or wishful thinking, but I don't think it's very easy to start from the other end, right? I think you need to understand the basic biology and connectivity and physiology of individual neurons alone and in concert before you can really know what it is you're looking for at the end.
What do you say to people who think all the studying of neurons and isolation and slices or something is not getting us there, and we need to be using some, you know, presence method to study vast numbers of neurons all interacting with each other at once in some meaningful behavior, and then that's going to help us.
It doesn't hurt us. It's really great to do all of those experiments, but there's so many things that we are fundamental that we don't yet know, right? About even individual neurons and how they integrate information, their basic physiology. So I think there's still a lot that we need to understand at that level even as we accumulate information and data about these more larger and up to behavioral scale experimentation.
Well, I wonder if some of the modulator stuff that you study, I've been asking you hard questions, so I'm going to give you something a little bit more down to earth. But the modulator work that you do maybe could provide some kind of lever for understanding function. Like if you were talking about sleep and wakefulness, these are very high-level things that we think of as not the machine, but the output of the machine. And if acetylcholine is key in some of that stuff, then maybe what we already know about acetylcholine could be put to use. So does acetylcholine act everywhere in the cortex kind of all together, or does it act in little pieces of the cortex, like to change the state of visual cortex versus auditory cortex? Do we know that?
Yeah, so that's a good question. A lot of the neuromodulators seem to be not very discriminative of where they release transmitter in cortex. So, for instance, serotonergic neurons release, you know, in frontal cortex and parietal cortex at the same time, right? The same axon. And those axons are huge. So an eLife paper estimated that each human serotonergic neuron may have 200 meters of axon if you add up all of the different branches, right? And there's maybe 80,000 serotonergic neurons, so you have 16,000 kilometers of serotonergic axon in your head. And I mean, it's just numbers that are not, you can't really process with a human brain, large numbers like that. Acetylcholine also has long axons. So in that same paper, they estimate 100 meters, and there's 500,000 of those. So that's 50,000 kilometers of cholinergic axon. But there's data that suggests that those axons are not as diffuse and are more targeted to smaller regions, still fairly large regions, but smaller regions of cortex than some of the other neuromodulators. So it may be that acetylcholine is released discreetly for certain behaviors or certain attentive processes in more localized regions of cortex. So that is a possibility.
So maybe one, I could have my visual cortex go to sleep and my motor cortex wake up, kind of.
That's interesting. Well, you know, so like some animals, right? Like, I guess dolphins. I don't know if this is just urban legend, but dolphins have REM sleep in one hemisphere and they stay awake in the other hemisphere, which is probably maybe important for breathing and while you sleep in the water. So that would be interesting to look at different brain states in an animal like that. And maybe you would see very discrete. I mean, now there's ways to image acetylcholine release, right? So there's fluorescent indicators for different transmitters, including acetylcholine. So you could actually watch either the acetylcholine release or the activity in cholinergic axons and see how uniform this release is. And if it's certainly temporally can be very rapid, and maybe it can also be spatially discrete.
Because the neurons that release acetylcholine are regular neurons that fire patterns of action potentials, and presumably those are carrying some signal. It's not just continuously firing slightly faster, slightly slower, but they're really doing things like other neurons, like cortical neurons or thalamic neurons do.
I think every neuron that fires action potentials, which is to me almost defining of a neuron, but not necessarily always, is important, right? I mean, the reason you have an action potential is likely important signal.
Yeah. But we treat some of the modulators as if they were sort of hormones. They're released into the tissue.
We think of them as slower, right? But they can act on the time scale of tens of milliseconds, right? So these receptors, which are not ion channels, they are clearly slower in the signal transduction, but they can be very rapid and cause rapid shifts in neuron responses. So they're not as slow as you might think.
Well, there are a lot of more questions to ask you about the cortex, but I think I probably worn down your goodwill on asking these hard questions. So thank you very much for joining us, Alan Gulledge and David.
I appreciate the invitation to be here. Thank you.
This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.